Bevor wir mit der Folge 300 starten, noch eine ganz kurze Botschaft in eigener Sache. Wir möchten all diejenigen ganz, ganz herzlich um Entschuldigung bitten, die sich schon für unser Buch entschieden haben und das bei Amazon vorbestellt haben. Denn all diejenigen, und es sind sehr, sehr, sehr viele, haben eine Stornierung erhalten und Amazon hat es nicht geschafft, trotz mehrfacher Versuche von unserer Seite den Änderungstermin, nämlich dass wir erst im Februar erscheinen, anzunehmen, sondern schreibt jetzt, man wüsste nicht, ob dieser Deal überhaupt irgendwann mal verfügbar ist. Möchte ich jetzt nicht näher darauf eingehen. Das, was auf der Kaufseite gut funktioniert, mit Prime, sehr schnelle Lieferung funktioniert, wenn man dort als Autor ist, leider gar nicht. Aber die gute Nachricht, ihr könnt es überall sonst vorbestellen, bei der Buchhandlung eures Vertrauens bei euch um die Ecke, erste Empfehlung. Oder zweite Empfehlung, so etwas wie Thalia, Hugendubel oder auch bei der Verlagsgruppe Beck, die auch den Verlag Wahlen umfasst, bei dem wir unser Buch herausgeben haben. Wir haben uns wirklich unfassbar viel Mühe gegeben, denn insgesamt sind wir nun schon seit 5 Jahren an dem Thema dran. Das Buch wird 400 Seiten dick, liest sich aber trotzdem sehr flockig und man muss es auch nicht alles an einem Stück lesen. Die Tatsache, dass wir noch die Svantje als Autorin dazugenommen haben, hat dem Buch sehr, sehr, sehr gut getan. Und Christoph und ich sind ihr unendlich dankbar für die viele Arbeit, die sie reingesteckt hat. Und wir drei AutorInnen freuen uns riesig, wenn ihr vielleicht diese Botschaft nutzt, um eine Vorbestellung aufzugeben. Denn wir würden uns über sehr, sehr viele LeserInnen sehr freuen. Wir haben ja pro Monat über 100.000 HörerInnen dieses Podcasts und wir hoffen, möglichst viele von euch auch als LeserInnen gewinnen zu können. Also vielen, vielen Dank und jetzt geht's los mit der Folge 300, auf die wir uns besonders freuen. Our guest today worked for more than 18 years at the iconic design company IDEO, most recently as senior partner and global managing director. Prior to joining IDEO, he trained as an architect and spent 8 years working with art organizations and independent artists. He chairs the board of Parsons School of Design and sits on the boards of the New School NPR and the Sundance Institute. He's the author of a fantastic book, I have to say, of my book of the year, called Making Conversation, 7 Essential Elements of Meaningful Communication. And he's in the process of building a company around this idea. We will ask him why it is so difficult for us to listen to each other and why we do reach each other less and less, although we communicate more and more.
For more than 4.5 years, we have been on our way to new work. How can a topic that plays such an important part in our everyday life create more meaning in our lives again? How do we get people to draw strength and motivation from their daily work again? How can better conversations help us in our various relationships? We are looking for methods, role models, experiences, tools, and ideas that bring us closer to the core of new work. We are always concerned with the question of whether everyone can really find and live what they really, really want in their innermost being. You are it. On the way to new work. It is episode 300, and we are so proud to have you as our guest today. Welcome, dear Fred Dust.
Thank you. And it's an honor to be the 300th. I'll have 300 short anecdotes to share with you because of that. Just joking.
Oh, it's so nice to have you on this show. We tried it, I think, during Corona. And it did not work out last time. But I think there's a reason. And the reason is that it's the best position to have you now. And I'm extremely proud, extremely happy. I read your book. I already quoted you in several times in our book, and it's so good to talk to you now.
And I
I'm delighted to be here.
I'm a YouTube guy, Fred, so I watch a lot of YouTube videos. That's usually what I do. Mm-hmm. And same here. Very, very excited.
Well, I'm delighted, actually. And I believe in the power of numbers, so 300, I think, is an auspicious one. I appreciate it.
Yeah, and we always start our conversation with the questions of all questions. Christoph, will you help me?
Fred, How did you become the person you are today? And you choose the length of your answer.
Yeah, I think I'm going to give you like three or four short kind of moments in my life that kind of, I think, add up for me. So maybe the first is actually more of a person. My parents were fairly absent in my life. My great grandmother was really kind of quite critical in my raising. And just to give you a sense of her, she was a farmer and she also worked in the steel mills. So in the US during the war, a lot of women worked in the steel mills. And then when it ended, they all like went back to being homemakers. My great grandmother was like, I love this. I love having my own money. I love having control of my life and having kind of like something. So she was very, very, very powerful woman in my life and kind of really helped guide me. But my great-grandmother was also a phenomenal storyteller. So I'll give you an example of one of my favorite stories that actually is in the book, but is also inspired the way I think about storytelling. My great-grandmother, coming home from the steel mills one morning, early in the morning, the sun is rising, she's exhausted. She would commonly say things like, just a few more days to tote the weary load. Like she wanted to just like, she was like, I'll sleep when I die. She was very, very looking forward to sleeping for a long time. And she's walking up the road to the farm and she sees this blue thing hovering in the air, coming closer and closer to her. And it gets closer and it's Jesus. And he smiles at her and she has the strength to go on. So the reason that I kind of pick that story is that it kind of gives you a great sense of who she was and the kind of ethics that kind of live behind her. I'm not a religious person. I do feel spiritual about things. But it also, I think it's just this kind of perfect example of a great story. You know, it kind of like, it's short. It illuminates something about who she is. It ends just where you want it to go on. You would definitely show up at the swing the next day because you wanted to hear what happened next in the stories. And so there was a lot in her and a lot in the kind of the power of the way she communicated that really connected with me. And in essence, actually leads to the next story that I thought of this morning, which is weird. I haven't thought about the story for a long time, but I was a latchkey kid. So in the US, that means like it was basically you took care of yourself. So I at home and took care of myself and had all kinds of weird mishaps and misfortunes and accidents and things like that. But what was important about that is that my father was the headmaster of my school. And when I was around 14, we had a class called speech class, which is where you practice talking, you practice telling stories and oratory and things like that. And she was like, I really want something that's going to like rip us open. The opening line has to be really powerful. And so I did a talk that started with the line, The Confessions of a Latchkey Kid, which is Whoa. Me telling the story of me being raising myself, basically. Well, Whoa. That caused huge uproar in my family. My father was furious. My father called the teacher. My father was like, because it threatened his career. And he was also like, he's not a great guy. And I remember going into school like the next day and sitting with the teacher at breakfast and her being like, you got to get out. And I ran away. I moved to Paris and lived in Paris for 2 years and basically never moved home again. I came back, lived in the theater basically, and then went to college and paid my way through school, everything. So I think that ability, what was interesting about for me that story is that it was like this moment where it's like, this simple thing that I thought was just giving a speech was actually a form of rebellion. I had kind of probably been sitting with this for a long time and been like, oh, wait, this is the way for me to kind of like tear open this kind of secret and then escape. So incredibly powerful for me. There's themes actually of running away in my stories quite a bit. And then I think so I'll give you two more short stories. One was that in college, eventually I went on to study revolutionary theory and was on my way to go to South Africa. So I remember walking to a meeting for fellows who were going to go to South Africa and work with soldiers in South Africa. And I was walking down the snowy road in Connecticut and I was like, wait a second. AIDS is happening in the US. There's a creative revolution that's happening, which is ACT UP, which is this kind of creative art activist movement. Why would I go to South Africa to fight that war when I could be here fighting a war that is meaningful for me as a gay man on the ground? And so I dropped out of school and joined ACT UP. and worked for that movement for a couple of years, just to kind of like, and learned a lot about creativity, art, the way that creativity can be used to kind of activate us and move us forward. So I think in a lot of ways there was kind of, there's a little bit of rebellion, I've realized, in my life. And then the other kind of critical moment for me was, and we'll talk about being at IDEO, but was actually leaving IDEO. As powerful it was to be there, the moment when I realized, and it kind of came down to writing the book, because there was sort of a concern when I was at IDEO that if I left to write a book for a year, that I was a very high, I made a lot of money for the company, that would actually affect the pipeline of the company. And I was like, got to do this. And I have to leave. I can't just like kind of take a year off. I have to like, I need to quit and do it. And that was a really profound moment where I would kind of had to realize who I am and what I stood for. And in essence, kind of find my new work, like what I was and how I worked and what I meant in the world through doing that. So those are four. The last one, I guess I'll call it, that I think is pretty critical is when Trump was elected, I was invited to go to National Public Radio to sit on the newsroom floor the night that elections were happening. And I didn't go because I had a feeling the country was going to go the way it did. And all of my work at IDEO then basically disappeared, because all of our work had been in government, large-scale philanthropy, large-scale public movements, things like, I mean, all of my work was systemic change. And that's kind of when I decided I was going to write a book, because I was like, what have I learned from all these years doing this work? And I learned that you could get creative and think creatively and design the conversations that mattered most in your life. And so I was like, I need to capture that in a book, and I need to capture that in the work I do. And I want to be spending my life helping people design the hardest conversations of their lives. So that really pivotal moment for me, actually. So those are just that's a little collage. Does that give you a sense? Or
A new level. That's a new level.
That's a new level. Yeah,
stories,
absolutely.
To like define. So that's definitely, yeah. And collage is a good name for that.
Yeah. Oh, wow. I have to breathe very deeply now to really get this all to me. Thank you for sharing this so openly with us. Thank you.
Not at all.
Maybe we even step back before you joined IDEO. I've read a sentence about you. You said, "I am a different kind of designer and architect." What do you mean by this, and how did you decide to become one? And how did you become one? A designer and architect, I put it together.
Yeah. I mean, it's really interesting. When I just to give you a sense, I hadn't planned on going to architecture school. I planned on going to get an MFA at UCLA. And then last minute was like, oh, I'm going to go to architecture school instead. So applied to the schools I applied to and got into all of them, but went to Berkeley. And I have to say, I didn't love the educational practice of architecture, in the sense that it's like incredibly harsh, quite difficult. It's not uncommon to find people who are in architecture school who find themselves deep in substance abuse, because like the critique is so hard, the hours are so hard. It's a rough place. It's funny, architecture AIA, which is a big U.S. Architecture gathering, They'll ask me every 5 years, and they're like, you just can't diss architecture, just come, but you have to be polite about architecture. And I'm like, okay, we'll try. But so when I practiced, what I really wanted is to do sort of what architects hadn't been good at. I think they're changing, but I really wanted to be an architect that was like really about clarity, really about kind of making sure that the client felt like they understood what was happening, that we were speaking in normal language, which I talk about in the book, that we were using our tools to really immerse them in what the spaces were going to feel like. So we would actually build full scale mock-ups of the buildings that people were going to be in, so you could actually feel what it felt like to be in something. Many of this was actually inspired by a practitioner called Christopher Hawthorne, who I'll talk about as one of my favorite five books. But he wrote a book called Pattern Language, which is about kind of unpacking the languages of cities and rooms and buildings. But he also did this practice where he would do full-scale mock-ups. He would be like, oh, let's try what the town hall would feel like by taping out a field and have people walk around it. So really wanting to kind of like bring some of the best of those practices into modern practice, and really getting our clients to be the architects themselves. And that's really the way I kind of structured my practice as a designer. And then ultimately, that's the irony of being now kind of a dialogue designer, which is what we call ourselves, is that we're designing structures for you to have conversations, but you're having the conversations. You're the protagonist of your own conversation, because we believe that's the only way to move a strategy forward, is if you feel as though it's like, it's yours. You gave birth to it. It came out of your conversation. So I've always considered designers as catalysts, as people who are kind of helping others kind of move forward, not necessarily always as the protagonists or the final makers, which is different than the way other people think about design.
Interesting.
I remember the first time I stumbled upon your name was when a friend of mine who studied business with me together in Switzerland joined Parsons, and he mentioned that, and he was talking about the design process. And then I joined a course about creativity at a business school. And you need to help me with a quote. What I remember back then is something that you said, that you kind of need to listen with the body, you need to participate in the context. And this really like is still in my mind. And because you explained that it takes away this powerful thing of listening, the question. And so many people want to ask good questions. But can you go back to this core idea of like being in this context and how this happened to become that important? Because this is something we experience today, that we do that all the time, but it's I think it's even harder these days to do that and understand.
I think that's right. And it's so much so that we have somebody on our team that we use as kind of the deep noticer, someone who's just listening and just listening with her whole body. And it's really interesting the things that she picks up that we often don't, if we're trying to kind of engage and make sure that people are having the conversation they need to be having. But yeah, I think that this is something that I believe it's deeply embedded in art, creativity and architecture practice, that you basically often, when you were like, you look at things, you go and just sit in a space and just take in what's happening and watch what's happening. If you're comfortable, I have a really lovely story that's from Paul Farmer's work. So Paul Farmer, kind of very famous public health worker, did a lot of work in Haiti. And I'll just tell you a little interesting story of like listening with the body, or listening by being in context. So he was getting data of bubonic plague in parts of Haiti where it just shouldn't have been happening. And everybody was basically saying, oh, let's do a cleanliness campaign. It's obviously because it's a filthy village. So they were sending all kinds of information into the village to say, hey, clean up the village, clean up the village. It wasn't working. Kids were the ones who were coming down with plague. So he took a team and he went out. He climbed the mountains, got way out into this village to kind of like just listen with the body, just be there. And what was interesting is, just kind of sitting there, not asking questions, not doing anything, he noticed a really interesting thing. The village was spotless, unbelievably clean. And what he noticed is that every morning, the women of the village would get up, put on a pot of porridge for their children, so be boiling on the side, and then they would sweep. They would sweep their huts, they would sweep the streets, they would sweep everything. What that meant was they were sweeping up dander from mice or rats that actually had plague in it, and that was going into the porridge. So it was in fact the fact that they were so clean and so responsible about it that the plague was being spread. So only something you could have experienced by being there, noticing, listening with the body. And one last thing, Christoph, funny little story. So when I was doing the proposal for the book, my agent sent it around to a few people to get feedback, and someone came back and was like, we think the book should just be on listening. And I was like, really? I was like, no way. I'm too good for that. Like, I need to do something on conversation. I'm not gonna do something just on listening. And I was driving back to the farm this week and like noticing things around me, and I was like, you know what? I need to write my next book on just listening. And so the next book, currently I'm talking and calling it like Keep Listening, The Things You Haven't Heard Will Change Your Life. And so it's basically about seven ways of listening and seven things to listen for. So that's the next book I'm going to be working on.
Okay, I'm excited.
We will dive deeper into the book later, but maybe we jump back then to the decision to join IDEO. I mean, at this time, IDEO already was fascinating people, even in Germany. I remember I was 1998, I had the chance to visit IDEO together with Reinhard Springer, former German advertising giant. He was, I learned this advertising from him, and we were there and had this visit, and I came back and said, okay, I can learn something new. This is such a different level. You were there 18 years. So what is the fascinating thing for you, or was the fascinating thing about IDEO, the people and the idea behind?
I mean, I think that there, and I can't really speak so much about where IDEO is today, but it's like, I think that what I found was that, so here's the thing, working in architecture, everyone was like, you're going to be unhirable, was hired immediately at a time when nobody was being hired. I had done retail experience, so I had worked at The Gap doing design for the stores. So I had very practical skills, and IDEO, I basically just like, it's funny, my boyfriend and I both applied to IDEO at the same time. They called me like a week later. I came in, brought my portfolio, and they hired me like the day after. And I think that actually broke up my relationship with my boyfriend at the time, because I think he was so mad. But I think the big thing is that they really needed someone to think about space design, because they had basically agreed to do a big university building at Stanford, the Stanford Center for Innovations and Learning, and they didn't have an architect on staff. They didn't have anybody on staff who could do it. So I came in, and that was my first project, which was looking at the futures of the way we work in an educational capacity. And that was a really amazing process and experience. And so that was like profound for me, just kind of getting into the, like, be like the sole designer who was really, I mean, I had a design team, but the one who was really kind of like could think about it from a space perspective. And I was really literally the first space designer at IDEO. And so what was great is that the company kind of just got out of your way if they felt like you had a good idea. And so I built a practice called Smart Space, which was basically thinking about, basically it was sort of saying, hey, like, space is the most important thing in your brand, in your work, in your place, in your home, in your healthcare. It's like, we need to be really smart about the ways we design it. And you have to really understand it as the client or the end user. Like, you have to know what you're making. Very successful practice. It was actually, I'm proud to say I hired the first Black designer. It was like first very diverse practice at IDEO. One of the things that's kind of shaken IDEO recently is its lack of diversity. And we were fortunate, because it's like I was able to bring in a really, really uniquely diverse set of people. And then my second practice, which it was called Systems at Scale. And so I think you might have, I wrote a piece called Systems at Scale for, let me back up. So at some point, there were all these little pieces of IDEO that felt like they were being not tended. Like, there was an education practice, there was a government practice, there was a change practice, but they were all small little things and they weren't really kind of being taken care of. And so I was like, well, what if we wrap this into one ginormous practice, a really big practice, and call it Systems at Scale, and look at systemic change, and basically say, how does education fall into this place? How do we do, like, how does government fall into this notion of systems change? So built that. From that, we launched IDEO.org, which is IDEO's nonprofit, which I think is one of the greatest experiments that IDEO ever did in diversity, because it had to be diverse in order to kind of solve the problems, because you couldn't go to Africa and solve problems in Africa without having Africans in the room. So it was actually a really powerful, powerful experience. And did that. And most of my work, my specific work, was actually in government. So I worked a lot with the Obama administration. I worked on with the White House, helping them kind of figure out how to keep talent in the White House, because they would find that they would hire really innovative people and they would not stay for long because of the bureaucracy. I worked with Elizabeth Warren while she was building Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which was a great honor, really remarkable leader. Got to do, like, I worked with the now Surgeon General, then Surgeon General, Vivek Murthy. We were doing an epidemic of isolation and loneliness in America. So we were kind of launching out a whole new mode of having dialogue in the world, so that we could actually get people to kind of get through catalytic conversations about anxiety, stress, and loneliness. So really, really remarkable work. And that, as I said, just kind of grew and grew and grew. It was a significant piece of the organization. Government collapsed, my whole piece of the portfolio collapsed with it. But it went on. Like, design for education is still a big thing at IDEO. The CEO, Sandy, who ran design for education, used to work with me. And IDEO.org is doing quite well. And government work never really quite came back. And I think that's partially because government really hasn't quite ever come back. To be honest, we're still in a funny spot. So.
Gleich geht's weiter mit On the Way to New Work. Und hier kommt ein New Work-Produkt für den Finanzbereich. Es geht um Moss. Moss ist eine Plattform, mit der Unternehmen Finanzen, also den Finanzbereich, vor allem fit machen für alles, was man bei New Work braucht. Was heißt das genau? Denkt einfach mal dran, wie viel Selbstverantwortung soll ins Team gehen? Eigene Entscheidungen haben wir bei Blackboard Bonds auch, dass die Crew selbst entscheidet, wie viel brauche ich, was brauche ich, wie möchte ich arbeiten? Und gerade die letzten 2 Jahre haben gezeigt, dass mit sehr viel Selbstverständlichkeit remote gearbeitet wird. Nur die Finanzabteilungen sind häufig noch extrem an Zettel gebunden. Und deswegen immer wieder täglicher Gang ins Büro, kennen wir auch, haben wir auch versucht, jetzt alles zu digitalisieren. Und das macht Moss für euch. Moss digitalisiert sämtliche Prozesse des Finanzteams, damit alle ortsunabhängig zusammenarbeiten können. Vor allem bekommt ihr auch beliebig viele Firmenkreditkarten für das ganze Team. Jeder bezahlt das, was er oder sie für gute Resultate braucht, im Rahmen des Budgets. Wie gesagt, das ist eine gute Sache. Wir machen das auch, noch nicht mit Moss, da kann ich noch nichts Eigenes zu sagen. Aber das, was Moss hier tut, da kann ich sagen, gute Sache, erhöht die Eigenverantwortung, fördert aber auch die Kultur des Vertrauens. Das definitiv. Ihr bekommt die ersten 2 Monate Moss kostenlos mit dem Gutscheincode NEW. Und ihr geht einfach auf getmoss.com/new. Da bekommt ihr alle Infos und ja, habt damit New Work in der Finanzabteilung. Und jetzt viel Spaß mit dem Rest von On the Way to New Work.
My sum up for IDEO over all this, more than 20 years I follow the company, is that you reinvented the phrase design. Or maybe we just in Germany have the wrong understanding of design, like making things looking beautiful. Design is more something in the IDEO world, like create things, make things work. Form follows function, I think company was using this as a phrase, but it's so much more than the usual guy on the street would say, what is design? And this company really reinvented it and said, well, design can make everything better, even governments, or even the way we are talking to each other. And that maybe is the gap to your book.
Yeah, I mean, Michael, just to build on that, because I think it's such a great point, is that the way I think about it and the way I often explain it is that everything is designed. In some way or another, especially, you know, it's like that there is design in every kind of element. And we have a choice of whether that design is good design or not good design. Mm-hmm. And so, and I think that for us not to kind of treat every moment as something that can be crafted and made better, not everything. Like, I mean, there's some things, like I talk about this in conversation, like whispered secrets, little like fun conversations, banter, gossip. That's great. Like, just use that as inspiration for what makes great conversations. But important conversations, ones that really need to kind of shift things, make things happen in the world, we need to think about them as things we can design, things that we can make. And that's really the premise of the book. It's the premise of our new company. It's the premise of we have a secret game coming out, which I'll tell you about a little bit later. But so it's the premise of everything, is that you can craft the hardest conversations and make them into not such hard conversations after all.
Can you give us a sneak peek for someone who has not read the book? If they now think like, what would it be? Like, give us an example. Give us something.
Yeah. I'll give you a weird one from the book, which is like, it's one of my favorites and it was super risky. So I have a friend who runs a newspaper. It's not a newspaper, obviously. It's mostly digital. He came to me because they were having real trouble. It's in the book, and it's like he was like, if it works, you can write about it, and it worked. But it's like he came to me because they were having real fraction in the newsroom. There was a lot of kind of fighting and infighting, and he was like, can you help us design a way of having a conversation that allows us to kind of see if there's a really discord or not? And the biggest issue amongst the newsroom was everybody believed that everybody else wanted to write about things that were different than what they wanted to write about. So there was not a kind of collective sense of what it was people should be working on together. So I designed two, and by the way, you do not go into an angry newsroom and facilitate that. That's like not a good thing. Like it's you're only going to get hurt if that happens. So I was like, there's no way I'm facilitating this. It's like, I'll design something for you. You have the conversation. I'll watch it. But like, it's like, we're not, I'm not going to facilitate it. I've now done this a couple of times with newsrooms and I'm like not facilitating. But so, I was at that point writing about a thing called Lecto Divino. Lecto Divino is divine reading. It's often associated with the Bible, but it can be associated with any sacred text or non-sacred text. And it's basically a thing where you kind of flip open a page of a book. It can really be any book. And you read a passage and you read it four ways. You read it for, and I'm going to hopefully I can remember it. You read it for like, what's the real story? What's it saying? What's a metaphor? What's another story that's like it in the world? Something else, which I can never remember four things. And then the fourth one is, what's God trying to tell you to do with this story? Like, why did you choose it? So I changed it for the thing into basically being like, what's the real story? What's the kind of like, what's a metaphor for what happens in the world? What does it mean to you? And then what is it trying to tell the newspaper to do? What is the direction about that the news should go? So here's what's funny about that, is that we came into the room. Again, they facilitated, they did their own conversation. They went into small tables. They pulled out their stories. By the way, their stories were all on phones because that's the way journalists look at their stories. So they're like, here's my story. And what the first thing that they found is that almost they'd only chosen like three stories. So everybody in the newsroom had chosen the same three stories of the examples of stories that they felt like had to be what they were focused on. So right away, they realized that there wasn't as much difference in the room as they thought, that there was a lot more alignment around it. As they did the Lecto Divino of the story, they realized what they didn't like about the stories was when they were, it was calling out, or it was only angry, or it was only kind of like a, kind of calling out the problems. What they really liked were the stories where they showed a solution and they made a hero out of the person who was the solution. And so it actually suggested to them a whole new way to think about writing their stories, which is really solutions-based journalism, really focused on kind of getting things out there so that people can start to kind of solve them themselves. So that's using a construct that was used for one thing, typically religious or spiritual thing, and then bringing that metaphor into a dialogue in a newsroom. That was really, really quite powerful. So that's one example. Can I give you one more?
Of course. As many as you want. It's your podcast, Fred. We're just listening here.
It's not. It's your podcast. I need to be asking you more questions. It's like I'm being terrible. But it's a my favorite is a thing called Hunch Hour, which weirdly was designed by a woman named Courtney Martin. I changed the names and stuff like that and shifted the models a bit. But the idea for her originally was it was a mechanism to allow people, typically BIPOC people, women who wouldn't typically get to write op-eds, to kind of begin to develop stories for op-eds. And the way it works is you throw out a hunch. And the way I talk about it is that a hunch is not your life's work. It's not a hypothesis. It's not your book like that you guys have just finished. It's a hunch. It's something you thought of in the shower. It's something you hold lightly. And you put it out there and then people can confirm or complicate your hunch. So you can basically, so you can say, I have a hunch that what we're seeing in the US is a rural urban blur because so many people from the city have moved into the country. And that's going to be better for culture in the long run because people are going to understand divides that they didn't happen. And you can confirm or complicate that. So you can say, oh, I'm going to confirm that, but you have to have evidence. You can't confirm or complicate unless there's evidence. And evidence doesn't have to be a white paper. It can be something you saw, a conversation you had. It can be anything. So it really levels the conversation so that everybody can be an expert in it as well. Mm-hmm. And so what works about that is that it's the language, hunch, it's light. You don't have to kind of take it overly serious. Confirm and complicate is not like, I hate it, I love it. It's like a confirmation or a complication. Mm-hmm. That language really matters. And then bringing the evidence to play really allows people to kind of do it. And what you find is you're able to build up ideas from hunches to real hypotheses within a course of like 20 minutes if you kind of do that conversation. So I've been doing that quite a bit. I just finished a whole series that was based on that in Australia, which was on basically youth, children, and how the pandemic could actually be considered a positive factor in their lives. And we started that with a hunch hour that was powerful. It was really fun.
How do you do that with conversations that seem to be on, let's say, sides and where you don't really have a dialogue, but people are just referring and leaving to their world of different opinion. I guess you know where I'm heading. In a world where it gets more and more difficult to reach other people, like having this opener for a conversation, having this, like, I mean, what you did with us is you pulled us into your conversation by the stories you were sharing, by the canvas you were building with the different stories. But how do you do that with people who block away right away in the first place?
So my feeling is it's all about intention. I don't think you shouldn't go into a conversation with the intention of changing somebody's mind or necessary. Like, and I just don't like it's mm-hmm. like, and so that's one thing. The second is I believe it's our job on earth, to be honest, like our purpose. So the ultimate goal is to know everyone you can, to talk to everybody you can, to like listen to everybody you can. That only makes you a better person. You get to learn more, but it also lets people get heard. And so you don't even start with the intention of change. You just start with the intention of hearing and understanding. This is actually, in essence, for us in the US, one of the reasons why we missed what was happening in our society for so long is that we couldn't really listen. We were like focusing on kind of like on a change or on the battle or the polemic and not kind of really listening to what was happening on the ground. And just it's a huge loss to do that. So it's why, Christoph, I'm like, hey, if you go in and you just listen, there's like the change can happen. It may not be a change for somebody else, but it may be a change for you. But the reality is letting somebody express themselves can be really powerful. So I'll give you an example. Our neighbor here, and I've talked about this before, but our neighbor, he was deployed during the first wave of the pandemic into New York. We were texting him every night to make sure he was okay. He came back and we were like, do you want to come over so we can hear what happened? He came back, he was sitting on our front porch, and he just told us all these horrible things he saw. And we just listened. You know, it's like, and he's a votes differently than we do, politically is quite differently from us. Like, it's like, but he just sat there and he told us these stories and he cried. And our job was, you know, we're two gay men living in the country. And we're like, it's like our job was really to listen. And he left, and Dave and I were like, I wonder why he came here to do that. And we realized he couldn't go home to his wife and kids and make them feel safe if he told them this stuff. He couldn't tell his friends who he wanted to kind of make sure that he could be, you know, strong and whatever. So that he really didn't have anybody who he could just kind of like break down and kind of talk about. So honestly, it's why I say it's like our first job is listen, and then you can move from there into something that's more significant. What I find is once you listen, then people are willing to kind of be like, oh, well, I'd like to hear a little bit from you as well. So.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's I think listening is the most underestimated thing we have as a skill, or we could develop as a skill. I really learned it the hard way over the last 4.5 years in this podcast, and I really could feel a difference in the way I'm communicating, because it's the first time I feel that I listen more than I'm talking, and I enjoy this so much. But in your book, I think it's a very strong part where you explain why so many people have difficulties to listen. Maybe you tell us these two little stories. If not, I will give you the tick, but maybe you remember what I mean. Why are we so bad in listening as a society?
I think I know the stories. It's so funny. Like, I have to say, like, the book is behind me and I haven't, there's like a ton of copies, but it's like, I haven't looked at it recently. I mean, what's funny is that there's a common misconception that listening in essence got occluded or kind of knocked out in the last, I'd say, 10 years, where it's like social media took it away and all those things. I actually trace the loss of listening kind of, really back to the dawn of a great era of innovation in the world of television. So
that's the story I love. Yeah.
So in the 50s, it's a really interesting, significant moment. If you go to like the Smithsonian, you'll see like the first ever TV trays. And TV trays, for you, if you don't know what they are, they were trays that you could take and eat in front of the television. So you could actually watch TV and eat at the same time. And at the same time that like the TV tray was invented, so too was the remote, channel remote. Like, so you could basically change channels from afar without having to get up. Frozen meals came out. So like Swanson TV dinners were invented. These are all within like a 4 or 5 year period. Really fascinating thing. The term anchorman, Walter Cronkite used the term anchorman. Our first televised debate, right? Where the very famous one where if you remember, it was like JFK and Nixon, and those who listened to it on the radio assumed that Nixon had won. Those of who saw it on television thought that JFK had won because Nixon was sick and he was perspiring. And so he had lost. And at the same time, we had the birth of pundits. So we had the Gore-Vidal debates. The Vidal-Gore, the really famous debates. Now I can't remember what they were. But these things all happened in a very, very, very close period of time. And so we saw like the loss of dinner time conversation, the kind of the pushing of the father figure to the anchor person or the parental figures over into the television space. Gradually, we saw TVs entering into kitchens, bedrooms, destroying intimacy. It meant that often like the first thing you would see in the morning would be whatever the tragedy of the night, the last thing you might see might be the same thing. So I actually believe it's been a long, slow degradation in listening. And it's like, it needs a serious kind of like slap. It's not enough to just put your phone in a box. That's not the issue. It's like, it's something way more significant that's kind of degraded listening in at least our culture.
So video killed the radio star and TV killed the listening skills.
and to put something on the table to like, let's brainstorm about it, because what I read for the book about the chapter of technology was a quote from, I think it's Ben Evans, who said in the automobile industry, they have a quote saying the first 50 years of the automobile, we had to figure out how is the design? How are the companies run? How do we construct the thing? And the next 50 years, we find out what you do with it, having all the drive-ins, the Walmarts, the parking lots, and so on. So if we now put that to the smartphone and compare that what you said about TV, we're here in the next era. And at least we sat in front of the TV together having frozen meals with a remote control and could have a conversation. Now everyone is there on their own, not having a fight anymore because everyone is watching. I have so many screens at home. It's crazy. It's insane. I was just counting while you were saying. It's just not one. It's like 8 or 10.
It's so funny. I was talking to a guy who's helping us with the game as we get to launch that. And he's basically like, I've got 8 screens. Like I can watch this and do this. And I'm like, really? It's like, I have one and then I have a big one. Actually, that's not true. Now you said I've got 5 screens around me. I apologize.
Yeah. How would we use all the stuff you learned, the methods, the way to think, the design, to like now put that into the right direction? Where do we start?
Maybe before we do this, we do the other story I love much, which is
that's also a hard question, Christoph.
You have to think about it.
Yes, I wanted just to give you some time while you're asking telling the second story with this. Why we train our kids in school not to listen, do we?
You know, I have to say that like I've been doing a lot of research recently on like kind of the birth of school systems, modern schools as we know it, and a lot of it, so much of it was tied to the Industrial Revolution, which was, you know, interestingly, like school counselors were put in right during the kind of dawn of factory work. And in part that was because they wanted to kind of be able to say, hey, maybe you shouldn't go on to do higher education. Maybe you should go work in the factory. So, I mean, there's so much in our school systems that are kind of tied to kind of like legacy ways or basically, and I think it relates, Christoph, to your question, to the way the world used to work, that isn't the way the world works at this point and now, right? So yeah, I do believe that's right. I think that one of the things that I used to talk about quite a bit is that often, and it might have changed, but whenever you would Google like kids in a classroom or kids like, you know, like whatever, it's like the first thing you would get is a picture of kids with their hands raised. And what that I believe that is like, and one of the things that we know, it's just like kind of the brain science of what of you raise your hand and like your body is goes into kind of fight or flight mode. Like you're kind of like, it's pure anxiety and fear. Mm-hmm. And so you're like sitting there, you're not hearing anything else that's being said around you. You're just focusing on what it is you're going to say. And that's like true if you raise your hand in auditorium. I don't know if you've ever done that, like in a group of like 1,000 people and you're just like, oh man, like I didn't hear anything that happened before I asked my question. But so I do think that there are kind of mechanisms in the school systems that have actually been set up to think about kind of poor forms of listening. One of the things I talk about a lot in the book is a thing called active listening, which is this kind of format that's like, it's very good in a situation like you guys are in, as like, because you're kind of, as podcasts, and you're trying to get somebody to kind of talk as much as possible and kind of get
If you're a coach, you can use it, but...
Exactly. But it's basically this notion of saying, uh-huh, go on. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, that is a... that comes from a thing called Rogerian therapy, which was a Carl Rogers. This is just like my geeky, like favorite thing. So Carl Rogers believed that he didn't believe that Freud could solve everything. And he didn't believe that Jung could solve everything. And so he basically believed that there had to be a new way that you could solve your own problems. And so he created this thing called Rogerian therapy. He had many other formats of therapy, not just this, where basically he would just kind of like nod and say, so Christoph, you would say like, just say something you're feeling today.
Tired.
Why are you tired?
The night was very, very short. Two kids were up very early.
So 3 hours why of sleep. So yeah, that's a, it didn't quite work with that one, but it's like, but it's usually but it's like
you're tired. You were tired because you have kids, and your kids
you have kids. Yeah, exactly. So why do you do that? So why did you choose to have kids? But anyway, so the idea is like,
Christoph, we learned this at Entrepreneurs Organization. You remember this is part of our education program, and I never liked it. Okay, I'm so happy.
It's so bad. It's so bad for the conversation because it does. What it does is it says, I'm not listening. I'm basically like, I'm egging you on to kind of unpack your own solution. So if you see it in an HR context, people will be like, they'll be like, oh, I feel like somebody like, you know, treated me unfairly. They're like, mm-hmm. Like, tell me why. But it's like, they'll never like agree. It's like, go on. And it's all a way just to kind of not have to kind of engage in the conversation in a serious way. So I think it's been a real degradation in culture at large. It's certainly something that you see in school context, but you certainly see it in workplace context. And it's really, really, I think, problematic.
Is it getting more problematic over the distance now that we do everything in the last 2 years remote, having a hard time to like do this? What we did a little chat in the beginning before we were starting, before Michael joined, and it felt very comfortable. But you were engaging in it and I felt very welcome. And so that was very inviting. But is this getting more difficult without being there, being present? And how is it getting more difficult? Two questions in one.
That's okay. Yeah, I mean, that's fine. No, I think it's interesting. Like one of the things that we do in our work, and I will say that for the most part, we do these things called catalytic convenings, kind of like these different kinds of conversational structures. But we do a few things that I think help things work, which is that we, at the beginning of every conversation, we set principles for the way the conversation has to be. So we'll do things like generous, warm, like, you know, trusting. Mm-hmm. Like, so it's like, and we're basically like, hey guys, like we're going to be in this for 90 minutes. If you can't abide by these principles, like of generous, warm, human, whatever those, I'm making them up. That's like, that was one that we used for this Australian client. Then you can step out of the convening. It's like, if you can't do it in 90 minutes. And interestingly, we did one recently where somebody got really cranky at the end of the thing. And then they were like, oh wait, I violated the principle. And they were, everyone was like, yeah, you have to go.
But I like principles, and that's what we do, Christoph. That's what we do at EO as well. No? That we say, well, we just talking about our experience. We don't tell you have to do this and this, read this book, do this, decide this. No, we say, I was in a situation when I had something comparable to your situation, and I did this and this and that, and did not help. And then I tried this, and this helped. So this is a principle we use in this entrepreneurs organization, and I think it helps a lot of doing peer-to-peer coaching. And I like the idea to create principles for each conversation up front.
But,
I like it.
But mm-hmm. the line is very thin that you cross to the other side with your story, putting it into a story from your experience and like giving a package, like a, mm-hmm. like a bomb in the package and give that to the other side. What I liked, and I'm not saying that this is happening all the time, but I'm just what I just saw, Fred, what you said, is that you do it without an intention. And this is behind. This is behind the story. You do that without an intention. And this is so hard to do. This is so hard to do if you truly want to do that.
Hmm. It is. I mean, it's like, and I will tell you, it's like, well, it is and it isn't. It's like, one of the things I think that you could do that I think actually would help us, which would mean that we wouldn't have to be working so hard to design dialogue and things like that, is relax into a conversation. And I think, Christoph, that's a little bit what we did in the beginning, is we were like, how are you doing? You know, it's like, oh yeah, what vaccine did you get? Like, it's like, I mean, we didn't seem like we're like geniuses. We're just like, yeah, I don't know. I'm tired too. And I don't even have kids. I'm tired. It's like, so yeah.
Yeah, and then not commenting, and I'm just need to smile because my son is quite young, and I asked him this morning, "What are you looking forward for Christmas?" This episode is like recorded before Christmas, obviously, and I was expecting like the gifts and the people he would see. I mean, we have two households, so I was expecting everything, and he dropped two names of his cousins that he doesn't see a lot. I'm like, okay, wow, that's cool. And that was a big surprise. And I could have put a judgment on that, saying like, oh, why not this, why not that, and so on. But that was so cool to see how, like, if you experience that, you think, okay, he made up his mind for himself.
Mm-hmm. That's so lovely. Sweet. That's a really lovely story.
He's a lovely boy, I can tell you.
What are you looking forward to for Christmas? It's
like just what I'm looking forward to?
Yeah.
Here's the thing, what I thought about, what he asked me last year, even younger, when this almost made me cry, when I was asking for Christmas presents and all this stuff, and he came to my bed in the morning, out of the blue, "Daddy, what do you actually want for Christmas as a kid?" Okay. Oh, God. I don't even know what to answer.
And he was two at this time. He was two, like, or two, like, and a half or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, so where I'm aiming at is I love to be reminded throughout the day that don't having this intention is a good thing. And I think exactly what you said in our conversation in the beginning, asking this question, like, how are you? If you really mean this question, and if you then listen, and we were chatting about vaccines, what vaccine do you get for the next shot? I mean, what a conversation in 2021. But but it's interesting to chat about it. And as I said, it felt very welcome and warm. And what I experienced in the last weeks especially is how many conversations in a business context have been tightening up, getting more tight, more intense, and we have to do that now, and leaving out this small talk in the beginning. And I have a hard time if I didn't sleep well, I have to admit, but I always try to like give the room. And that was where I was aiming at with the question, what do we do about the smartphone and distancing topic when we come out of this TV area sitting in front of the screen, and now everyone is sitting in front of 8 screens. How do we
at the same time?
Open? At the same time, how do we leave this open? Where do we start?
But I mean, I think what's interesting is like, so I've been working with my team now for 2 years, mostly virtually. It was really funny. I have a neuroscientist on the team. I met my neuroscientist for the first time like maybe a year ago, and just because I'd only ever seen him on a screen, I thought he was like 5'7". I thought he was like this like short little thing, and it's like he's like 6'3", and I was just like, wait, who are you? And then he was like, I'm Rob. And I'm like, oh, hi Rob. But it's like, so what's but you know, it's really interesting. Like, I think there are some people who are talking to you are best talking about the notion that this has actually humanized people that hadn't been humanized before. And so, you know, like we're trying to keep her out right now, but I have like a 8-month golden retriever puppy. Like, it's like, who will sometimes just jump up on my lap, you know? It's like just the way it is. And I think there are aspects of this that have kind of allowed us to see people where they are. I mean, you're seeing me in my pretty messy study, you know, in the farm, and that this is kind of like, this is who I am, this is the way I live. So I think there's that, but I also do think, Christoph, not just making time for small talk, but purposely designing it in, purposely having it be there, even kind of putting specific kind of questions out there, like, what are you looking forward to for the holiday? Which is like an interesting question for us, and reveals so much about who you are as a human. I think the other thing that we've done with our team, it's funny. I did this significant series of convenings for Rockefeller Foundation, really significant. And one of the things I really wanted to do is make sure that people didn't think that I was the one who had designed the convening by myself, because I was the one who was leading the convenings. I didn't want people to be like, oh, well, it's all Fred's genius. And so there'd be moments where I'd be like, purposefully, I'd be like, ooh, I forgot what's coming up next. Elena, can I have you kind of talk about that? And she would come and she'd be like, yes, let me explain it, because Elena was the one who did the design. And so it's like, I purposefully design in these very human, like, forgetting moments to basically be like, I want everybody to see the person who made this and know that it's not all me, because I'm the one who's kind of guiding us through it. So in ways, what's sort of funny and maybe good practice for us is we've had to become far more, we were talking about being non, you know, kind of not having intentions, but for some of the other smaller things, things that we would just imagine happen naturally, we have to be more intentional. We have to say, oh, we have to make sure that people kind of get these kinds of moments in their day.
I would love to step back to where we started with the listening topic, where you said active listening is not the best idea. You created a phrase which really made me feel so good about, I can learn listening. I will have the chance, even if I'm 57. And you called it creative listening. Maybe we dive into this, and I think it will answer, could be the second half of the answer to Christoph. I think it all starts with listening. Even with people who just want to tell you their story, you can listen in a different way, and you can help them to be better in conversation without that they realize it.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. So one of my favorite parts of the book, and I gave you a short example of it, was Illuminations, the idea of kind of how to tell these really, really, really short stories. And one of the things that I find that we don't do very well is ask people to tell you things that you want to hear. Like, so it's like, so sometimes we'll just be like, oh, go for it. You know, what is it? Tell me about your day or whatever. But it's like, but you can ask somebody to tell you a funny story or an embarrassing story or something like that. So by asking people to kind of like, and you can actually give them the tools to be better storytellers. So if you can say, can you tell me, Michael, I'll do this. Like, Michael, can you tell me a short story about the last time that you blushed and what it was that caused you to blush?
You see now my bad English. What is blessed?
Oh, blush. Blush is like when you kind of get embarrassed and turn.
Ah, okay. Oh, wow. Let me give. I had such so good. The last weeks were so good to me. I really have to dive deep back into it. Oh wow! But I like the story. Yeah, I like the story. I like the question. I like the question. Give me.
Maybe I'll tell you mine while you guys think. So quite literally, it was last week. I was on a call with a woman who runs a foundation that's about to shift everything that they do. And she basically told a story about seeing me on stage at Aspen, then coming down and sitting next to her. And she was just like, I love that guy. He's like, he really works with logic in places of emotion. And I blushed so hard because I'm really bad at taking compliments. Like, I can do anything, but and I also get really red. And so I was just like beet red. And I was just like, let's not talk about this. So that was the last time I blushed.
I think, I can tell you. I had to dive deep into this. So my wife is a highly sensitive person. She works as a she can talk to animals, and she is a shamanic healer. And in Germany, there's a YouTube format called Hyperbowl, which is very popular. A million people subscribers, 1 million subscribers.
Okay.
And she was asked, the Hyperbowl, the idea behind this, we are giving people with very special backgrounds, like a murderer, a billionaire, a medium. Yeah. And she was a tier telepathin, so animal telepathics. And I didn't warn her. I had something in my back where I said, well, is it a good idea to do this on such a popular platform? And she did it. And she got her first shitstorm ever. Oh. And it was so bad. There were so mean comments. And I had the feeling, I watched the video. I loved the video. She did it really cool. I follow this, her on her path since years. And I believe there's something, I can't explain it, but there is something in it. And I really was pissed. I said, well, you assholes, that's not fair to treat her like this. You can say, well, I don't believe this. You can do it. But yeah, I was really pissed.
That's really infuriating. By the way, I'd love to know more about that, if you wouldn't mind giving me the information. Because it's one of the chapters about listening to animals. And I had a funny experience with my dog that died recently, where the day before she died, she was walking around carrying a little stuffed animal. And I was like, David, she's telling us she wants to die.
Oh,
and he's like, you're being ridiculous. And I'm like, I promise you. And yeah, she died the next day.
Yeah, I will make sure that you put two guys need meet each other. I will make sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool.
But you know, Michael, that's a really interesting point. And I think it's an interesting kind of meta statement on listening. So, and I'll just tell you this, when I started doing stuff publicly, you would get lots of haters. So like, and like I did a PBS NewsHour, and I talked about talking to a hunter on our property and basically saying, hey, if you're going to hunt the property, can you bring us some venison? Cause at least like we will, whatever. And I got all the vegans were furious at me, and they were like, just like, how, like whatever. And so I just through Twitter. So I got all this hate through Twitter, and I basically went back and I was like, hey guys, like, I have tons of friends who are vegans. If you want to try to convince me to be a vegan, I'm sure I'd be up for the conversation. They're like, I bet you would. I bet we could convince you. And it turned really nice. And so we really worked on kind of leaning into the haters and being like, let's try to understand, which is, I don't recommend for everybody, but it was like, it was sort of a way to be like, hey, you can turn these conversations if you want to, if you want to put the energy into it. And in that case, I felt like I had to, because that was sort of my work, was to kind of see if we can turn conversations around. Mm. So
you would now like help into the storytelling, how to like share that, then to let this open, let it flow.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So like, it's like I got attacked when McKinsey basically chose it as like their favorite read of the year. And somebody wrote and was like, hey, how does your ethos jive with like the suppression of voices in Russia? Because McKinsey had just had some big scandal around that. And I was like, I'm a gay man. Like, it's like, if you believe that I like look for positively on the oppression of gay and lesbian voices in the Soviet Union and the massacre in Chechnya, then you got it wrong. And they were like, oh yeah, sorry, that was for McKinsey, not for you. It's like, so it's like, if you can like lean into it, people will be like, oh yeah, okay. Like I see the human is what they're looking for. And it's sort of the same way where it's like, when you lead with a, you're human, I want to hear about you. And then it's like, you're like, okay, well, maybe you didn't think I was a person. Let me show you that I was a person.
But how could we, if we then think design brought us to this way of getting onto sites and conversations, we're looking on our own screens, we're looking on our own headlines, we believe from reading 5 or 10 headlines that we are kind of an expert, although the real experts know they are not even experts. So how do we start to use design to like revamp that or make something out of it? Because I'm a big technology fan and enthusiast. Michael knows that. I love like when he started with playing with his light, which light is that? What can we do? How can we embrace? I don't know, all that stuff. So where would you start such a process then?
Yeah, I think that there's a bunch of things. I mean, I would say that a lot of the systems that actually kind of are up right now, it was lack of design that kind of got us into this thing. So, I mean, you could argue, and people do argue quite strongly, that Facebook is really terribly designed in kind of all ways, in addition to kind of the way the system functions and the ways that the algorithms and the technologies are kind of designed specifically, right, to kind of to be pushing certain kinds of things. So I think it's like there's a lot of kind of malintent or poor intent or lack of intent in the ways that we've been designing. But I also see a lot of really interesting people do. Like I just had a guy come by the house to show me his new startup called Trove, T-R-O-V-E. And it's a, I think it's called Trove Collective is the URL, but it's basically, it's a place to kind of show all parts of yourself. So it's basically kind of like, it's like you can attach all different kinds of feeds to it. So you can basically be like, here's who I am as a full person, which is just a really different kind of way. And so I think there's some really interesting, because by the way, I am not anti-tech. I love technology. I really do. Like, it's like, I would say my iPad is like probably like my single most kind of, I use it for all my drawing, all kinds of things. But I do think that there can be some clever, real thinking. And it's not so much about the interfaces and the systems. It's actually about the communities and the way the communities are designed themselves. And the ways that actually those communities are kind of what the feedback loops are around that and how that kind of plays. So, I quit Facebook 8 years ago, partially because I was just like, there's nothing good here. No good is happening in this space. So I think we have to just be really careful and thoughtful about what we let into our lives. And then I think it'd be really interesting for us to look at like what, and that's why I love this Trove thing. What is a social media construct where you could actually really, you can see fullness of somebody?
So they call it social blogging. I've heard about this. They call it social blogging. Yeah,
that's right. And you can, and so you can do things like, you know, it's like the really simple things. Like you'd be sharing like, what are your five favorite restaurants in your neighborhood? So people know. It's like just like really basic stuff, but it's like, mm-hmm. It's a really nice kind of new, it's a new thing that I think is gonna be really shifting out that landscape.
I mean, what is interesting currently with technology is what is happening around this idea of Web3 or the metaverse idea where you have, you own certain things of the content. And I mean, like right now, one thing you can own is your domain name. That's pretty much it, which is like worldwide in the same registrar and all that stuff. Michael has a whole story of how to get a domain ending, which is very complicated and a cool story itself. .hiv is here because of Michael and team. And if you like put that out and saying like, what if you can own 10 more things, just 10 more things, what will happen from there? And I love these design games in like, what is happening then? I'm just not good enough in like focusing on this one thing, or let's say duties around here distract me then. But this is where I really see where it could head. I mean, most likely we underestimate what we can build from that, because many good things are built from that. But
I'll just to give you a little, and then it's a nice kind of little segue into something that we're working on right now. But so my husband's an AI artist. He focused in AI. He was really looking at kind of the inequitable distribution of AI and technology, looking at he lives in a rural context. So he trains AI on nature. And the idea is that like it gradually learns nature. And so there's a piece behind me, which is a large dandelion that is kind of like, it's not really a dandelion. It's a computer's vision of what a dandelion is, that he kind of works with the computer over a period of time. And he obviously then has, in addition to selling the real work, he also sells NFTs. So he's quite big in the NFT space. And so we own quite a bit of stuff in the virtual domain. But one of the things that we're interested in our stuff, so I think I told you that we're doing a game. So this is this secret game. It's called Campfire. And the idea behind it is that the game has these two components to it, where you're basically like there are players, so there's like the people who are gathered around, and then there's the game itself, and the game basically plays you as you're going through it. And the way it works is that at some point, if you're playing with like 4 to 8 people, somebody breaks in a good way. Like, it's not like we did a gameplay in Los Angeles where a young 27-year-old woman was like, I just realized I'm too old to succeed. And everyone was like, whoa, 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 puts the game down, and they all kind of like circle around the person to kind of help that person. But what we think about this game is that the game needs to have guides. There needs to be people who can help guide you through it. So rather than just be like, hey, play this game, it's like, Michael, I'm going to teach you how to play the game. You're going to play it 4 or 5 times, and then you're going to be a guide for the game. And we're thinking about actually kind of creating a way to have a digital ownership of your status as a guide so that you can basically say, I'm a level 9 guide for Campfire. I can do this thing. And so it actually becomes kind of a little kind of like, can become an interesting little marketplace around it. So anyway, something where a different kind of take on your ownership notion, but that you can own an expertise by kind of practicing to be something and be recognized for it in the digital landscape. So,
which is a crazy hard thought to follow. I mean, like in the future, but this is the cool thing about designing the future, right?
That's totally right. Yeah.
Fred, I'm usually the German timekeeper, and Michael now is smiling because he knows, like, the minute I miss that point, we have a good conversation here, yeah. And I miss that completely.
It is absolutely okay.
Yeah,
I have something before we end up with our two closing questions. I would love to tell you a wish. And you may know, Christoph may not understand it because he did not read the book, but I will tell him later. I would love at some point to step into your world, Fred.
Stepped into my world, but you've stepped into my world.
Yeah, but I mean, I would love to work a week as your internship or whatever. It's one of your tools for creative conversation. You name it, step into the speaker's world. Yeah. And I would love to step into your world for a week or whatever. You don't have to say now yes or no,
And you would love my team. I mean, that's actually, honestly, and I think this is actually a making conversation thing. It's a noticing thing. It's a hearing thing, which is that I feel like one of my only skills is seeing really good, kind talent and kind of bringing them together. And that's actually, that's a pretty amazing skill to have. I've been really happy. So my team, you would love just to kind of see them and the way they work would be really, I think you really enjoy it. They're really lovely people.
Very cool. Okay. Christoph, what are our two last questions?
Well, the one question is, it can take a while. Let's see. We ask for must read books or inspiration that you would want to share, where you get your inspiration from. That's what people want to hear.
If you don't read, it can be your dog. But if you read, we would love to.
No, you know, it's very funny because I'm a fairly avid reader. In fact, I'm not joking. Like I would average like on a weekend, I'd at least read a book a weekend. And then I had this funny thing, which is like the kind of the moment where you finish a book and then the pandemic, like kind of like, meant that I haven't read as much over the last kind of the first year, really picked it up again and like loving it and actually just really looking forward to the holidays and just kind of diving into books in a really deep way. But so here's the thing. I don't read that much nonfiction. I read a lot of fiction.
We love fiction as well.
Yeah. And so, but I'm going to talk about a couple nonfiction that I do think are interesting. I will say Pattern Language by Christopher Hawthorne is something to take a look at. What's really interesting is when you start to see the world of patterns around you and the way spaces kind of build certain kinds of patterns in the landscape and have done that like throughout centuries and centuries, you start to sort of see pattern in general. And I think it's actually really useful even in thinking about patterns of conversations, which is one of the frames that I originally had was like, might we look at like the different patterns for conversations and how they work? And so that's a book I would really recommend. A book that I give to everybody that I think is really interesting is a book called On Tyranny. I don't know if you know that book, but it's a, let me just grab it really quickly. It's funny because now there's actually a comic book version if you want to read it in the comic version, but it's 20 Lessons from the 20th Century by Timothy Snyder. Wow. And it's basically how to recognize if you're heading towards a fascist government. So I'll give you an example of one. And it's written in a very inclusive and human way. So it's like one of the points is like, if part of your job is to carry a gun, then like, you know, treat it and others around you, especially carefully and thoughtfully. It's like this very kind of like kind of lessons on that. So that's a book that I highly recommend everybody have a copy of. This is a podcast which I think is phenomenal and it's like, it's really dorky and I love listening to it, but it's called Seth Rudetsky's Back to School. And what it is it takes famous actors And he basically says, let's take you back to high school. And who were you in high school? And it's just really amazing thing where you take these kind of like famous people and then you are like, okay, like I was a total loser. Like I was like, and it's just this amazing, funny human thing. And it's also really powerful in terms of learning how much like theater and the arts actually help kids who are different. Cause it's like difference is so hard. And it's like how often like creative contexts allow kids to kind of be heroes in ways they wouldn't be otherwise. Mm-hmm. So it's a really funny show. It's had 3 seasons out. I love it. It's not for everyone, I think. Okay, 2 more. As Station 11, the book, and now there's a TV show. But if you don't know what Station 11 is about, the end of the world, but it's like beautiful and ends in utopia. I don't want to give it away, but it's and like not in a fantastic way, in a really stunning, mm-hmm. simple way. And so I really it's Station 11. I can't remember the name of the woman who wrote it. And there's also a HBO show out now of the same name, which is really quite spectacular. And then, gotta say, the only thing I've been back into the theaters for was to see Dune, because I read Dune when I was like 12, read the whole series like in like a week. And it's a really interesting, if you haven't read it, it's a really interesting meditation on the nature of economies, the nature of climate change, the nature of oppression and colonialization. It's also it's a meditation on fear and kind of self-reliance. It's a really beautiful, amazing book, and loved the movie, loved the first half of the thing. So those are the 5 that are kind of all over the place, but the 5 that come to
Thank mind. Thank you so much.
Nice spread. Thank you.
Yeah, really.
Michael, it's your turn. Shoot it off.
Yeah. So the last question, you can answer if you say I can't handle this topic. Some of our guests say, well, I'm not interested in a bucket list, but we always ask the bucket list question, and we define it like this. If you have 3 wishes, one thing which should happen or what you want to do in life, an experience. Second thing, what do you want to learn in life? And the third thing is do you want to give back? So experience, learning, giving back.
Yeah. And it's funny. It's weird that you said that, because it's like my first thought was like, it's like, do I have a bucket list? I just basically am always like, I want to do everything I can possibly do. That is my nature. It's just like, it's cool. Get out there, do everything. Like, it's like, even if it feels like it's hard or weird, I'm not that interested in jumping out of a plane, that kind of thing. But I feel like what's been really interesting is like how not traveling as much over the last 2 years. I went to France like a couple weeks ago, which was like, I said, because we used to go 4 times a year to Paris. And I was sort of thinking like, oh, it's kind of weird fun now. It's like, it's fun, weird. Like it's not, it's sort of this thing, but I'm really interested in getting to know like the local communities, helping the local communities. Like there's a new Montessori school that's here that I've been like, I really want to kind of go there and help them. So I think one of the things I'm really interested in is kind of like how local can you be and still feel the kind of the meaning and depth of kind of like the exploration that you get when you get to travel the world. I would really like to, it's funny, I never think about this. I haven't taught in a long time. And it's like, I would love to be, I think it could be really fun to take this and teach it as a curriculum. And I don't know why I haven't thought about that. And that's one of the reasons, like, even like the Montessori school has been like, could you teach us to our faculty? And I was like, I'd love to do that. So it's like, I want to do that. And then, as I said earlier, I don't know if I'm answering the exact questions you have, but it's like, I think there's something to be written about listening. And, I think the way I'm looking at it is like, there's the human act of listening. There's really interesting kind of like, there's a tribe here that basically declared themselves their nation state, and suddenly the whole world listened to them. So they got like political freedom. I went listening to animals. There's an artist named Thomas Saraceno who he collaborates with spiders. And I'm really interested in that interspecial collaboration. I'm really interested in like the kind of the breadths of the ways we can start to imagine listening in our lives.
Wow.
I love episode 300.
Yeah, definitely.
Thank you so much, really.
What an episode.
Yeah, thank you so much. And what I did forget in the beginning is to say thank you to Mark Winter from SY Partners, former guest of us, who introduced us to you. I asked him, who are the the people we have to have in our show, and he just named you. No one else. I said, you have to talk to Fred.
Yeah, that's like, and so I'm, ridiculous. There's so many better people, but okay. Thank you. All right. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot, Fred. I have to say thank you for guest 300, Michael. You made it happen, and this was a gift, since the episode is recorded the week before Christmas, a Christmas gift. Why is that? Because it opened up the space of conversation and seeing the world in a different way. So I would say a very, very perfect episode 300, because I didn't expect that.
Yeah, I wanted to thank you first for doing 300 episodes together with me. It was such a ride. We had ups and downs, more ups than downs, but we had our downs. Thank you so much for doing this together with me. That's the first thing I want to say. And then I want to summarize our talk with a quote of Adam Grant, New York Times best-selling author of Give and Take and Originals and host of the TED podcast Work Life. He was telling us on the book of Fred the following. He said, Fred Dust has helped some of the world's most powerful people have more productive conversations, and his book offers actionable advice on how we can all stop talking past each other. I love this, and I'm happy that we had him on the show.
I will read the book. I didn't read that many books this year. I will read that book.